Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
I'm Dan.
And I'm Alex.
And welcome back to On Air, everybody. We have an exciting announcement. We noticed a few weeks ago, but what is the latest ranking of On Air, Alex?
We are in the top 2% of all podcasts globally.
Obviously, there are a lot of podcasts, but being in the top 2% of all podcasts is just crazy. So we have to thank you guys for tuning in to our, you know, sometimes we drone on and on. We're tired some weeks, but we have fun and we are so glad you guys have fun with us. And just, I'm going to take this opportunity, shameless plug, to say, please, if you have just a moment while you're listening now, whether it's on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever it may be, just, you know, close down the main window while still listening and just go click to rate the podcast. It helps so much. It takes 1 second. You can literally do it right now. And then, you know, we can continue and we will be very grateful.
Yeah, it's amazing news. The fact that we've reached the top 2% globally is something that we wouldn't ever have imagined that we would have achieved in less than 1 year. So as Dan said, we extend our heartfelt appreciation to every single one of you who tunes in across all of the platforms. And then also when you guys make the time to write in to us, send us messages, you let us answer your questions, your travel dilemmas and so on. It really makes it feel like a proper little, I don't know, I feel like we've got our own aircraft and we fill up all cabins on every flight every week, and you and I are in charge entirely, and everyone just kind of lets us do our own thing. My God, if we started an airline, that would just be the best airline could ever.
I know.
No, but speaking seriously, like not saying, oh, we would have this and we would have that. I genuinely think we would be able to streamline one of the most efficient, profitable, you know, strategically thought out airline startups to hit the earth.
And we would hire the right people. It would be, we would hire all our listeners. Well, some of you.
No, actually, let's actually, since we've got a little bit of time, let's go into that. If we were to launch an airline, where would we firstly base that airline? Where are we hubbing?
I've thought about this a lot. If I were to launch an airline, if we could choose anywhere in the world, what's the most profitable market? It's a very tough market, but what's the most profitable market? The U.S. It should be somewhere in the U.S., right?
So you say the U.S. and I start to think, oh no, does that mean it has to operate like a bus? You know, like is it a shuttle? Listen, and I was hoping that you were going to say it should be based in Singapore, right? You know, the Southeast Asia kind of, you know, the it's a lucrative market, super profitable.
Yeah, it's growing. I don't know. Singapore,
I mean, imagine you and I were tasked with establishing an airline, for example, that was operating between one of the most profitable routes on the domestic side of things, which is Melbourne and Sydney. What would that airline look like? I mean, what would we be offering our passengers for the 1 hour or so flight between Melbourne and Sydney? Are we going full on Wizz Air? Doubtful. Are we going full on, you know, Emirates and QR? Also doubtful.
How about this perfect world where no slot restrictions exist, everything is empty? Why not choose Heathrow? Would be good
I would have said Heathrow as well. Yeah, to be honest,
because like just click delete on BA and put our airline in instead, and we would. I mean, look what we could do on London to New York, the most profitable route in the world. What we could do there would be so fun and so incredible. And everyone in Europe and everyone in the US would want to fly us transatlantic.
What aircraft would we be operating across the Atlantic?
Well, if we had to order now, I guess 350, right?
Yeah, I think I would want the versatility, efficiency, flexibility that a 350 would offer, either the 900 or 1000, I wouldn't mind.
And would we have first class?
Given that London to New York is the world's only billion-dollar route, I would say that we would need to have first class, yes.
Yeah, I would say, okay, here, I've said this before on the podcast. My thought about first class is, here comes trigger word, ding, 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 halo effect. You create a halo effect around the whole brand. So put one row or two rows. Okay, maybe make it single aisle for first class.
Yeah. Two seats. Like Etihad A380.
Yeah, with two seats or four seats in total. Very few. You just, I agree. Maybe four, because it would need to be some sort
four of... Four is plenty. Yeah. Because I would want a nice sizable business class cabin of around 46, 48, whatever.
Exactly.
So, I'd want the remaining four to be first, so that you have 50 first and business class seats.
And make it... Okay, listen to this. If you look at... We spoke about this episodes ago as well. If you look up mock-ups of Cathay Pacific's potential new first class, where basically it's like two floors on a one-floor aircraft by adding like almost a bunk bed type of thing, which I know doesn't sound very luxe, but they make it look absolutely stunning. If you make something like that with walls that can go down, so you could potentially have at least a two-person suite where the bunk beds would be like against each other between the walls. So when you take it down, you'd have a big double bed with like a whole living room downstairs, an incredibly comfortable bed up there. Everyone on Instagram would go wild, or all over social media, and we'd be the talk of the town.
I think, I don't know about that elevated bed though. That's, I mean, there would be room.
It's just more
again,
space
think
efficient
of like,
for
it is efficient,
non-double
yeah.
decker.
It would have to be executed in such a way with the trim and finish and the design and concept that you would maintain the level of, you know, excellence and opulence and everything that you would expect that we would be charging on a first class transatlantic route on the world's only billion-dollar route. So you and I are in charge of London to New York on our carrier. It's operated by an A350. We have first, we have business. The next crucial decision point, are we having premium economy?
Yeah, absolutely. It's the most profitable cabin in the world.
Yeah.
The most profitable per square whatever.
Are we having a fixed shell premium economy product where the seats slide within the shell, or do the seats actually recline?
So as someone who has actually flown premium economy.
I'm sorry, I don't know why you're laughing. I've flown premium economy as well.
Maybe not so recently, but as someone who just did a comparison series.
So shady. Can you imagine? I look forward to doing the podcast with him week in, week out, and he just can't help himself. He can't help but throw shade to the main host of the podcast. It's just, where is your respect,
the main host.
You insubordinate co-host?
Let's rewind and just acknowledge that as someone who has recently reviewed Premium Economy, in every single video, I said my biggest frustration, the thing that makes me so eked out by premium economy, is people reclining way into your personal space and making it impossible for you to get out without asking the person in front to move their seat up. So as much as people complain about fixed seats, I say it has to be fixed, but it has to have good padding because you
cannot. So I'm picturing like Japan Airlines kind of fixed.
That type of thing, because that's the huge letdown and the huge frustration with premium economy. So
because Singapore Airlines is not fixed, is it?
It's not. No. Very few airlines have it, and Air France did have it, but people complained. I just think you need just to add a bit more padding. And by the way, I just sent you a mock-up of what one of the Cathay concepts look like. I hope you tweet this when the episode goes out.
Okay. I'll do that.
So this is kind of...
Oh, okay.
It looks very...
That does maintain a real... Oh, look, there's even a Esquire magazine in there. Can you see?
So I'm going to send you... Okay, this is actually crazy with this. So hopefully you can tweet these because the bottom image...
I will.
Is like
I'll tweet it when this episode goes out.
The bottom image is the full suite.
I have seen this. Okay, I do know this rendering.
This looks beyond incredible.
I hate the headboard just behind the bed headboard on the left.
Focus on the big picture, not the finishes.
Yeah, okay, but otherwise, that is a clever use of space. I agree.
Yeah, this looks so space efficient, but also like the best first class seat
super apartment
I've pretty
life,
much ever
it?
Seen.
Yeah, that's great. It does make it, it's always fascinating. So for example, during Farnborough Air Show, I had so many guests, but also friends and even some relatives come down to Farnborough, and I was showing them around different aircraft, and we were running in and out of different manufacturers. And the overwhelming kind of conversation, the consensus amongst those that are outside the aviation sphere that we exist within, is that they were saying, it's incredible what a clever use of space, you know, airlines are able to carve out in their design. So they were boarding, for example, the G700, the new Gulfstream, and any gap on that aircraft, even if it is where, for example, the headboard meets the interior wall and there is like a 3-inch width gap, you can be sure it is a storage space.
Yeah.
With a lockable door that you can slide in, for example, the safety cars or chargers or whatever. I mean, it's just amazing. And actually, you need that level of creativity to extend a little more into home interiors where people are moving into, for example, if you move in or buy an apartment in New York, you know, Dan, how small these can be. And in London as well, it's any of these big cities, you're tight for space, right? Even when you stay in hotel rooms. So I always think they need to look at aviation for inspiration as to how to genuinely have excellent storage solutions, meet luxury, meet opulence, meet beautiful designs. Because if there's one industry that has cracked that code into, you know, space saving, but maximizing the efficiency of the space, I think it's aviation.
Yeah, but it's interesting that we're seeing this introduction of Business Plus. You know, I'm thinking Air France, for example, which I flew recently, where so always in a bulkhead row, the seat would go underneath, basically, or inside a storage unit. So the storage unit would be there to put crew bags or whatever it is, and then you just go in. But that's been taken away in order to create a much bigger space in a lot of these plus products we're seeing. So I guess the airlines in that case have done some kind of revenue calculation, see if at least 50% of passengers or whatever it is, 30% pay X extra to pre-select this seat, it's going to be worth it, and we'll put the storage somewhere else. And that makes me think of something we didn't discuss last week, which we have to talk about, which is quite interesting. So Etihad will be receiving their first A321LRs next year, summer next year. And so far, the bulkhead rows in that, which, you know, we've seen many of these narrow body business class products in a 1-1 configuration with direct aisle access, and they all have spacious first rows. But Etihad, at least so far, seems to be marketing it as first class and selling it at first class prices. So it's not an upsell. It's a full on first class whatever, which I guess implies for now there will be a first class soft product. But what is your take on this as from a Middle Eastern perspective?
Well, I thought that this was a somewhat peculiar decision, not least because the direction that we've seen Etihad trend is away from first and the residence. And for example, with the introduction of aircraft like the A350, they have this pretty much off the shelf product in business class and the same in economy. For the A321LR with Etihad, which is going to be operating on routes such as Phuket from Abu Dhabi, that's from next summer. Yeah. I can't really understand how they're going to bundle these tickets up with routes that don't offer first, which is the majority of them, to then switch it to a first class ticket on a single aisle aircraft, when really it's most likely, I mean, should have been, I think, a business class consistent ticketing offer. So we say that because how are they going to massively elevate the experience between their existing long haul business class and that mid-haul single aisle first
Yeah.
When there is no real clear difference at the moment between their existing first and business on their current aircraft, aside from the seat itself, right? These are back from Etihad's glory days where they had Nicole Kidman doing the adverts and they spent all this cash and got themselves into a lot of financial trouble, but had a lot of beautiful cabins. I just didn't think it was, it doesn't seem as of yet like it's the right decision.
Yeah. I mean, can you imagine stepping off an A380 apartment from London to Abu Dhabi and then your connection, you saw, okay, A3, you don't read the rest. All right, similar. You get on board and you get an A321 and it's also first class. The only
unless we have to stop thinking about this as a what the actual seat is and think of it more as, you know, like how, for example, Qatar, if you're flying within the Middle East or the Gulf, it's first in economy, and that's more tailored to the needs of that demographic of traveler. So Gulf travelers usually require an increased luggage allowance, you know, a little more than you would get in business. They would want XYZ. So that way they sell first instead of business, so that you get 50 kilos if you're flying in business. They differentiate the service with things like Arabic coffee, caviar, things like this. So do you think it's just that pattern?
Well, that wouldn't make sense because this is a long haul flight. So,
yeah.
And they're also offering business class. So it would be one thing if there was no business.
On the same aircraft.
Like, yeah. So it's one row of first, just the front row, the bulkhead. And then there's many rows of business. So that's what's confusing because they're really making a distinction here. And
okay. Forgive me. Okay. In a 1-1 configuration, you will have on either side,
row
on the left side and the right side, row one will be, quote, first class.
Yeah.
And every row behind that, assuming that's not with a divider.
Yeah. So that's...
is going to be business.
Yeah, that's what I meant when I said that, you know, we're talking about these business plus products, which if you look at Starlux, you know, Starlux does a similar thing with the first row on its A350, that it's basically a business plus, but they're selling it for like $20,000, insane rates. So,
blimey, this is the allegorification.
It's so sad that this is spreading.
Carriers.
We don't have pictures of this seat, so maybe it will have, you know, floor to ceiling walls. It will be the same seat, but floor to ceiling walls and blah blah
Doubtful.
Blah. Or they will just, you know, reverse this decision later. They're trying to see how much extra they can charge for it. That type of thing. But now that you brought it up, this is something we've never discussed and something I think is quite an interesting topic. Why does Qatar Airways and only Qatar Airways sell their business class within the Middle East as first class, but Emirates or Etihad don't?
So from my understanding, the former CEO's take on this was always that it was less about the product itself in terms of the seat and everything you can touch, and more about meeting the needs and expectations of the Gulf travelers, while also being able to leverage that in order to maximize revenue. So in simple terms, as I said, Gulf travelers typically, if you were to generalize, would have wanted more luggage, an increased luggage allowance when visiting family, flying from, for example, Doha to any point in Saudi Arabia. And to understand this is to understand that in the Gulf, and when I refer to the Gulf, I'm talking about Kuwait, Oman, Bahrain, Qatar, UAE, Saudi Arabia. Have I forgotten anyone else? No, I think that's good. And in the Gulf, it's very common to have mixed families, right? So, you know, mum from Qatar, dad from Saudi, mum from Saudi, dad from Bahrain, and so on. And it's with that, there's a lot of movement intra-Gulf, a lot of, you know, family meetups, family occasions. And then you've got all the usual things that we all face in life, and weddings and all sorts. And they tend to, you know, really travel pretty the opposite of light. I mean, travel heavy, is that the opposite of light?
Yeah, but, like us.
Yeah, like us. So the idea was that they were going to tailor their ticketing structure to this to ensure that instead of you having the business class that you get internationally, they tailor the ticketing as first class, you get more luggage allowance, you have access to Al Safwa, the first class lounge in Doha's Hamad International Airport, which typically, you know, previously could have been quiet if they didn't extend it to the Gulf flights, because you typically were only in Al Safwa if you were flying first class, and first class only existed on the A380s in recent history. So if you were not flying on the few A380s that they have, which was always less than 10, then, you know, there's nobody in Al Safwa. So that it was Al Safwa, it was luggage, it was, again, the extra Q points and now Avios, previously Q Mars, and that would also be reflected in redemptions. They were able to do this by knowing that the demographic of traveler expect the highest of service, the highest of service excellence, of opulence and so on, and also that they were absolutely willing to pay for it. And they have been willing to pay for it, and they continue to be willing to pay for it. And so that ticketing structure model has worked. Don't get me wrong, it does cause confusion. My friends all the time say, Alex, I'm confused. I book first class. I'm going to, for example, Amman in Jordan, and I'm in a Q suite, but I thought Q suite was business. And then I have to have this whole explanation that I just had with you now about how it's part of the ticketing structure, not tied to the product itself when it is intra-Gulf or intra-Middle East.
Yeah. And by the way, isn't it absolutely mind-blowing the prices people pay for, it's lovely to be in a Q suite on a 45-minute flight. Do you need it? Absolutely not. And the fact, like, when I am flying economy on some QR routes within the Middle East, and then I get an upgrade now for just $1,200. And I'm like, how much is that per minute that I'm paying?
I know.
Yeah.
It's true. And as you know, the majority of the passengers on that route, for example, will either have been connecting, as you know, from elsewhere, and therefore have just been transferred into that and have not paid the full, you know, first class fare, or even the slightly discounted first class fare. They wouldn't have paid that because the ticket cost is spread over those two tickets. It's a transit model, the hub and spoke model. We've touched on that before. The other side of who else is in that cabin are those that are flying ex-Doha. So those that are flying with origin Doha, usually it's the VFR market, the visiting friends and relatives, and they pay for it. They do pay for it.
It is, because I'm just checking now, like an example, Muscat to Cairo. I put Qatar Airways and Emirates as my options. Both will have lie-flat seats, obviously slightly better on Qatar Airways, unless you get an Emirates A380, which you can get on some flights to Cairo. But so here when I search, Emirates is $1,200 one way. Qatar Airways is $1,400. So the price difference isn't too big, and you get a lot of benefits flying QR because it is first over flying business. And also, you know, using Google Flights, which we always recommend, you see the little pop-up when you expand that it says like Emirates business class, Airbus A380 flight number, and then you see Qatar Airways first class. So I wonder what maybe an average traveler would think when they saw that. And go, ooh, first class for only $200 more, and choose to book it.
Well, then again, I mean, the same thing exists in the US, doesn't it? I mean, I can fly domestically with Delta first class. True. If I'm starting my journey in the Middle East, I'm expecting some kind of apartment. And then I board and it's a CRJ.
Yeah, that's so true about the US. The difference here, though, is that all airlines sell it as first class in the US. But in the Middle East, it's only one. So I imagine it's a bit confusing, but the US calling whatever that is first class is truly a different discussion, especially since you don't even get lounge access. It's okay. How about here's an interesting discussion point. Would you rather fly intra US, quote unquote, first class, just the highest cabin on a narrow body, or intra European in business or the highest cabin? Which is preferable to you?
Well, I think the US, you get more, don't you? In terms of you actually get a solid product on board for...
Yeah, the seat.
I mean, at least you get a different seat. Europe, we're just talking about an empty middle seat, basically. So the question is, do you prefer an actual, you know, sofa-style recliner or an empty middle seat? Obviously, we know which one is better.
Yeah,
but I understand why the European business class is, you know, why it is.
Yeah, but... We're missing in the US, you get inedible food. In Europe, you get, usually quite decent food. In the US, you don't get lounge access. In Europe, you do.
True. So there. I mean, you know me, I don't eat on like an hour flight.
You wouldn't touch anything served on a US carrier. That's true. For sure.
The thing is, though, I don't. Yeah. Okay. That's like a guarantee. You're right. Maybe yeah. I would. No. For example, on my recent BA flights that have been short haul, and if I've taken the upgrade to club or just, you know, done it on a redemption or something, I don't eat because, and I love food, right? I mean, I'm a proper foodie, but the 1 hour flight, I can just go without the heated up, you know, tray.
Yeah.
In the, I can just go without. You just don't need it.
Yeah, that's fair. But I think our consensus is US is still preferable because what matters most is more space, more comfort. And that's what
and Wi-Fi as well. Like they've been ahead of the Wi-Fi game forever. Like back when we were really, really young and still you board flights. Now, my auntie was just complaining to me that she flew London to Larnaca. It's almost a 5 hour flight and there was no Wi-Fi with British Airways because she was on a Neo that had no Wi-Fi. Day's lost work.
Yeah, it is funny when you think about Americans coming to Europe and some of the things that are just normal in the US, like air conditioning or like Wi-Fi, working fast Wi-Fi.
Ice.
And yeah. And being from Sweden, you know, Scandinavia.
You're from Sweden.
Hi, I'm half Swedish. This place called Gothenburg, ever heard of it?
Nope. Keep going.
Okay, moving on. We're lucky to have quite high standards in Sweden. So like that contrast isn't as dramatic, but it like the no Wi-Fi on planes does sort of go in with this. We only take cash. We don't have air conditioning society that still exists in many parts of Europe. Yeah,
that's so true. Yeah. I wanted to ask you, we had a question that came in and this is something I've been meaning to ask you for a while. He says, I flew on a Turkish Airlines A350 to London, specifically for the A350, and one cabin crew member who was sitting in front of me for takeoff as I was sitting in the exit row told me, stop filming, it's illegal. And I'm quite a shy person, and this was a sold-out flight to London. And as someone who has flown on at least 40 flights, I know that filming on board is fine with the cabin crew as long as I do not film them or the passengers. So he says that he was in a window seat and filming out the window, and that he thinks that she took advantage of the fact that he's young, had a camera, and then she proceeded to kind of make fun of him with the Turkish passenger sitting next to him, and it was really obvious and uncomfortable. He's put, so overall, I would like to know if you, in this scenario, would talk back and continue to film in your seat in terms of out of the window and the food, or just stop filming like I did. He's put that as an aviation lover, it went from an exciting, fun flight on an A350 to a very boring 3 hour flight because he loves keeping videos of each flight as he takes them as memories for his future self. I felt bad when I read this because that's, and by the way, a small similar scenario I witnessed in the summer. So most of the summers, you know, I was in Greece and in the airport, this, I assume, YouTuber was like, American, was going to a Delta gate and was like, hey guys, so, you know, immigration was super swift considering that. And no, it did sound like you though, didn't it? And anyway, she was immediately told by the Greek police to stop. Then they were like, you can't film anywhere in this airport. She was like, what? Like, yes, I can. Like she kind of, you know, started the my rights discussion and he was like no, and then they were like, where are you flying to? And she said where she was flying to, and then they proceeded to walk over to the gate of that aircraft, and I thought, oh, they're alerting the ground staff / the crew of the fact that she was filming. Now I blame her for filming too close to the immigration and security area, because as you're departing internationally from Athens, you go through immigration first, security is directly behind it. She was filming in that area. I won't even hold my phone in that area as if it, you know, could be implied that I was capturing anything, because you're just not meant to, and it does show you, and that's a kind of blanket rule you should accept in all countries. So to go back to the message that we got and this little experience, what would you have done in that scenario? And then, I mean, has this happened to you before? What did you do?
Well, okay, first of all, I'm amazed that this stuff still happens in 2024, because everyone knows what a YouTuber is, what a TikToker is. Back, you know, I was recording YouTube vlogs almost a decade ago in person on planes when no one knew what that was, let alone, you know, people in their 40s and 50s or whatever.
So has it got easier now that they know what it is?
So much easier. Back in the day, it was always, why are you recording? What are you doing? Now it's like, oh, are you a YouTuber? Like, it's changed so much, you wouldn't believe it.
Okay.
So I rarely hear this on flights these days. Mm. I hear it more at airports. And I think I've said this before, how actually it happened so recently. Oh my God. I wish Oscar could remind. Okay, I'm not going to remember. It was somewhere. It was so satisfying. It just happened, I swear. Like last week, someone came up to me and said, you're not allowed to record here. And I go, oh, can you show me where that's written, please? And they go, what? And I go, yeah, like if it's illegal to record here, can you show me where that actually is written in text? They just scoffed, turned around and walked away.
Oh, so now, do you not worry that if you're in a foreign country where you are not familiar with the, you know, entire country's legislative agenda, that you could be rocking the boat by saying, you know, prove it?
No, because if it was someone who looked like a police officer or something, obviously I would not. But if it's, and first of all, and I wasn't like in Kenya or something, like where I got detained, good times, but
memories.
Yeah, exactly. But if I'm in a country where I feel like there's reason and law and order, then I'll say it. And I'm not recording in immigration or at security or whatever it is. On that specific flight, for our listener, I would try to record discreetly, you know, going forward. So that person, okay. They were told they couldn't record during takeoff or what?
Yeah, he seems to suggest that it was at the beginning of the flight, because he then said that the rest of the flight, what followed, was just a boring flight for him. And he had specifically chosen the A350. So from what I can gather from the text is that he starts recording as the crew sit down opposite him. He's in the exit row. So it suggests that it's takeoff. Yeah.
So I mean, unfortunately, the takeaway here is that I never sit in a row where I'm going to be sitting opposite crew. Not only because it's just extremely awkward, but because...
It is awkward, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, you're just like, so are we supposed to talk or what's going on here? But
I always wonder if I'm like, so do you come here often?
God. And it's like, I feel so bad for cabin crew, because you just always ask them the same questions. Like even I can't help it. I'm like,
are you flying to next?
Yeah. I'm like, so how long is your layover? Oh, you have a lot of layovers that are that short, huh? Yeah. I know you guys work so hard. Thanks for doing such a good job. So what's like your favorite destination?
Well, that's nice.
And then I always ask favorite destination, layover length, acknowledge that they work hard kind of thing. Anyway, back to this point. Besides avoiding that row, I would actually not film if they asked me not to until they got up. Then I would resume filming while they're doing their work, try to be discreet about it. If they give me an issue again, I would ask to speak to the purser and just very calmly explain, I'm just recording I'm not recording any people. I'm not recording the crew. I'm just a huge aviation geek kind of thing, hopefully to calm things down. And I've said this before. If anyone's like, oh, where? Oh my God, I remember where it was. It was in the Air France lounge in Paris. I was filming the buffet at the buffet, the lounge buffet. And this guy comes up to me and he spoke French. And he was telling me in French, you're not allowed to record here. And I go, can you show me where it's written? And he didn't speak any English in the Air France
because
lounge.
Because they have no obligation. It is France. They
yeah. So
no
then
obligation.
He starts pointing at his colleague who comes over. So then I'm talking to both of them. So yeah, I go, he scoffs, walks away when I convey that they can't show me where it's written. Then they come back because I continue recording. And then they say, is there something wrong with the food? I go, no, there's nothing wrong. I just want to share this with my family, I say. And they go, oh yeah, because if you share this on social media, we could get in trouble. I go, oh really, why?
Because the food's horrific.
Because maybe the food doesn't meet your
It's a buffet and they should be banned.
Yeah. And I'm like, oh, no, don't worry. I only have positive things to say about it. They go, yeah. We don't like people recording the food here. So I'm like, this is a very interesting takeaway on so many levels that's going on here and the insights I'm getting, because surely the specific staff wouldn't get in trouble for the food looking bad in an Air France lounge. And if the food is bad, that's on the airline, not on the staff. So what's your take on that?
I can remember a similar scenario like that where, you know, where they're trying to remedy they're not actually remedying the root cause, but they'd rather remedy the secondary part of it. A very similar thing, but not related to food. I flew back on a flight. So I've flown twice by coincidence with John Holland Kay, who's the former CEO of Heathrow Airport.
Yeah.
And I don't know him. I mean, and one of the, on the first flight, I sat down. You know that I've always traveled with Dettol wipes, okay, recently.
Yeah.
And since the last few years, Clorox wipes, because they're super strong. Anyway, <Yeah. laughs> I sit down and I do my usual. So I start wiping the seat. And, you know, in a, just a discreet, normal way, no one can even notice that I'm doing it. And I wipe specifically when the headrests are leather, you know, they should be, they're quite easy to be wiped. Anyway, as I'm wiping, I overhear the crew say, oh God, that guy in 1 kilo has just wiped his seat and all black stuff has come off on his wipe. And he's done it in front of John Holland Kay, and he's just seen. And they were like, oh, you're joking. As if, like, the issue is that the CEO of Heathrow saw me doing it. So I was the issue because the plane seat was absolutely filthy.
Oh.
And I remember listening, and I did not engage at all. I didn't, you know,
yeah.
I didn't say something. I didn't continue it. And it's not my problem if John Holland Kay happened to see that, yeah, your seat is absolutely filthy. And he probably, I assume, you get two types of people looking that if they look, because I know how to do it discreetly. If they look, you either get one who is looking, thinking, oh God, his wipe has just gone black. So, you know, the seat must be really dirty without us realizing.
Oh,
or you get the other side who are like, oh, why is he wiping his seat? And I'm like, but it doesn't bother you, Linda. Like, it's nothing to do with you. You know, when I see someone looking, I think it's totally fine that you are content with sitting how the seat is ready for you when you board. I like to know that it's been wiped because I like it to be that extra bit clean. It has nothing to do with you. You can't see it. You can't see me doing it. Doesn't, you know, involve whatever. But again, the crew were more worried about the fact that John Holland Kay had seen it rather than coming to me and saying, by the way, sorry that your seat was absolutely filthy and you're sitting there with two black wipes that were formerly white 30 seconds prior.
Can you imagine then if you had been filming you wiping it and then filming the wipe?
God.
That could have
been a thing. It's not right, is it? Because
Did you see when I posted earlier this year about when I flew Scoot and the seat was absolutely filthy? I made like a reel about it. And
yeah, I did.
And like,
I think it gave me a little bit of anxiety.
Yeah, but
I do remember that one.
And it's just so wild because people's response, like obviously the majority agree, but there's always like 5% or something of people who are just like have the most like unhinged take on things. So people
as if
are
you're
like,
crazy for wanting it clean.
Yeah. Like how do you expect an airline to clean its planes? They're trying to make profit, so they fly them as much as they can. You should understand this. And it's just like,
I understand airlines that are able to maximize revenue and also keep a clean and sterile environment.
Yeah.
You know, it's so sorry that your understanding is not there, but in that scenario, mine is. So why do you have to lower it? But that extends into society when you go into a restaurant and the table hasn't been cleaned and you have to have that awkward moment where I have to kind of tread carefully around the waiter or the waitress and say, and when you have a chance, would you mind just cleaning their table, please? Because it's sticky and it hasn't been cleaned since the last person. And it is as if you have asked more often than not something. It's as if you've asked for their firstborn, you know, or
But I've noticed that people have a very negative response to germaphobes. Like you, even talking to you and doing this podcast with you has made me a bit more of a germaphobe. And I really
the idea. Like, it's no, you know, for example, where I am where, for example, I travel with wipes, that does not mean that I need other passengers to do it. Like, I'm quite happy, as the saying goes, for you to do you. But yeah. I don't understand the weirdness about when somebody catches you doing it. It's like, oh, look, he wants his seat clean. He must be absolutely psychotic. I'm like, nope, just hygienic. Yeah. Just clean. Just used to cleanliness rather than having to put up with, you know, the grease of the passenger who was in the seat 40 minutes prior.
Yeah. When Oscar and I were in Sweden about, I guess, 6 weeks ago now, Oscar was very sick. I'm everything I say, I'm like, have you seen this on our Instagram? But Oscar posted on our story that he was very sick. So we went to the hospital because my stepmom is a neurologist and she was really worried he was having an aneurysm. Maybe. Yeah. Like,
oh God.
Yeah. Cause his symptoms were very much like that. So she was like, go to the hospital immediately. Don't risk it. So we went and a part of us also suspected Oscar might have COVID at that point, but we took a test. It was negative, but we know tests might not necessarily work that well these days. Yeah. We took a test that was negative. So
we're like 4 years into four or even 5 years into this thing. Yeah. So
these were new tests though, not expired. But we go to the hospital, we wear masks out of courtesy to everyone else.
Mm.
And the first thing, the two nurses who are helping Oscar, the first thing they say is, why are you wearing a mask? They're not. We go, to keep you guys safe.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Like the tone of their voice, I'm like, you are healthcare professionals. Why are you judging us for wearing a mask? What is happening?
But it's just weird, isn't it? Because that actually takes us back to those horrible days of the pandemic where it was like, I don't ask you why you're wearing a blue hoodie, even if I don't like it.
You know?
So just let, and I guess that brings us to a wider passenger etiquette point of just, you know, in order to keep the environment as friendly and calm for each other as possible, you know, you do you and get on with your thing and don't worry so much about what is happening elsewhere. I understand, though, to go really back to how we got here, about the point of crew not wanting to be filmed because they perhaps are insecure about, the intent of the person recording. And I can sympathize on that side of things. And so is that why this lady, to our listener, the crew member, responded in a bit of a harsh way, but to go on and start kind of gossiping about him with the passenger next to him is a bit shitty, isn't it? And it's a bit totally. Like that's uncalled for entirely.
At the same time, I think I would submit an online complaint to BA about that.
To who?
Wait, which airline was it?
It was Turkish.
Oh, never mind. This story, I got lost somewhere along the way.
We went down many, many avenues, but it was Turkish. But before, I mean, what's been the worst in terms of what you've experienced as a YouTuber? Because when I watch your videos, and your videos are fantastic, I genuinely do believe that in terms of the airline review world, yours are the best on YouTube, right? So one of the things that I always take away while I'm watching it is, oh, he has balls to be videoing so much of this because I just know I couldn't. I like the invisibility of not having to do that. And so I think that, you know, you're putting yourself out there just by holding your phone slightly in front of you, you know, it just changes everything. What's been the worst reaction that you've had?
Well, okay, I honestly can't remember if we've spoken about this or how extensively we spoke about this, but when I was 15, I also made like a very surface level reel about this, but have I even told you when I was 15 and I flew United, and it was my second time ever flying business class, and we booked it because I was, we don't need to go too much into it, but I was not doing very well and I needed to get to the US as urgently as possible because I was really suffering in Sweden. And then the only thing available with points, because, okay, that gets into other family stuff, but we needed to use points. The only thing available was United Business. And my dad and I didn't even realize that it was business when we booked. But then when I finally went to select a seat, I was like, oh my God, I'm flying business. What is happening? So Finally, the big day arrives. I get on the flight, United 767-400 in the 222 classic business. And so the thing was that there was a family in the row in front of me, two mm-hmm. parents and their kids. Somehow I had ended up in like row one or row two on the opposite side. So I was in the last row because I would always record landing and takeoff back then. So they asked me to switch. And I said, I'm so sorry, but I really want to sit here so I can have this engine view because I'm making a video. That was in my early days of YouTube. And they seemed fine with it. They started asking other people. I managed to switch very quickly. But then I don't know if he was the purser. US Airlines don't even really have pursers. But this guy, this big, bald man, probably in his 40s or 50s, comes up and sits down next to 15-year-old me and literally starts interrogating me and going, what kind of... So I go, yeah, I'm a huge fan of aviation. Like, I really want to record the wing. And this was before having electronic devices on during taxi and takeoff was allowed. Mm. And he goes, you're not allowed to record during landing and takeoff. And I go, yeah, I know. But I want to record during the flight. I really enjoy seeing the wing view. What kind of weirdo records on planes anyway? And then okay, I'm trying to find the email from my dad.
What did you do? Raise your hand.
and do what?
Well, he asked what kind of weirdos.
Oh, yeah. No, because I wasn't that kind of kid. Like, I didn't have maybe the balls that you did at that age. So I just...
Goodness, Dan, I don't want to get slapped with an explicit tag on Spotify when we upload this.
It's a phrase. It's a phrase. So, yeah, I can't find the email right now because I wrote it all down and sent it to my dad. But it was like the... You know when Gen Z uses traumatic and they use it a lot too much? But that was...
A bit too much.
It was just such a... deeply embarrassing.
You were a kid.
I was literally 15, flying all alone, transatlantic, and this guy was calling me a weirdo. He was like, literally for 10 minutes,
did you stay
in the
same seat?
Me. I did. And then he goes back to the galley, and I hear the whole crew laughing when he tells them about me, and they're like, oh, I don't want my ass hanging out on YouTube. I better not see him recording me. And I'm literally, I was mortified. So that was the most horrible experience. And they didn't even catch me recording. They just literally found out I wanted to record the wing. Yeah. So that was that. And then, I started getting a bit more ball. This is like, things less bad than this have happened a lot of times. But I remember years back, after we were friends, flying Aer Lingus, and this was back
I remember that.
This was back in my free flight days of 2016, 2017. I think this was the end of 2016, and after literally a year of persistence, I had gotten Aer Lingus to agree to give me a flight to make a video about them. So I get on at JFK all happy, I'm recording, because this is literally something Aer Lingus has given me for free, and they're in on, and the purser comes up to me and says, what are you doing? You're absolutely not allowed to take any videos or photos in here. And I go, I'm actually here with Aer Lingus to do this. and she goes, no way. I don't believe you. You put that camera away right now or I'm going to kick you off.
Whoa.
And I go, listen, here are the emails. I had to pull them up on my phone. Here are the emails from your colleague about this. She reads them, disappears. 5 minutes later, okay, I can't remember, maybe you remember this better, but some guy, either the station manager or a cop or someone, comes on board and is like, sir, we're going to need to see what you recorded. Looks at it and then goes, you're not allowed to record here again. And I go, look.
Purpose of the trip was Aer Lingus wanted you to record your experience and document it on YouTube as a YouTuber.
Yeah.
Well, it was a little bit of Aer Lingus' fault to have not communicated that to the crew prior to the flight.
Extremely poorly done.
Yeah.
But it's just like, so I show him the emails again, and I try to explain, look, I'm literally the only reason I'm here and is to record this video. And someone is going to be very upset with me and maybe the crew if there's not a video from this flight. So finally they agree to it. But then I'm like, wow, this flight is off to a great start after all this.
Is that video on your YouTube?
It is my first and only time flying Aer Lingus.
Something to watch tonight, guys.
That's good. It's not very good, but yeah, that's the joys of early YouTube. Now, that's why I'm saying nowadays it's usually so much better because people understand the concept of making videos for the internet. And people, I mean, I think like this whole idea people used to have, or cabin crew used to have, of like, oh, like, what if this gets to someone who can do something dangerous by knowing exactly where this and that cupboard is? But this stuff is so public about every single aircraft in the world. Yeah. You can find a picture of every centimeter. So there's nothing to worry about in that sense these days.
You're right. You're right. Well, look, that was it was something that has sparked my curiosity about, you know, how it is for you these days. Because as I said, when I enjoy your videos, I do wonder if you get those like awkward moments that I know you used to talk about. And I guess I wondered because you've stopped telling me about them, and that means that they've stopped happening.
Yeah. And now I'm so much more tough than you just get thick skin doing this a long time, whether it's from constantly being bombarded with hate and whatever it is. So yeah,
You're doing fine. You continue to do as you do. It was interesting to find out about all of this.
Yeah. So if you have 1 minute, I just want to read something super quick. And then we're going to go into my points Q&A, which, guys, is going to be a dance special. But
I need to hear this as well, because I that's where I join the listener in that part, because I am not strong on miles and points outside of a couple of airlines only. And Dan is super across it. So we said, okay, let him lead this segment and I join you guys as the listener with my notepad and start taking notes.
Yeah. Yeah. We might do more in the future because I am very tired, but I have a brief one. I just have to read this quick DM from Jay, because this is the reason I love doing the podcast. This is the reason that we just find this so special. So Jay who sent many questions before, he goes, do you believe in the law of attraction? Because I definitely do now. Laughing emoji. So I arrive at the airport for my flight to Dubai from Heathrow already a bit late, but we go through security and then I'm looking down and I see gate A10 in the distance. And I think, oh, poor Dan getting trolled by Alex all the time. Imagine having to get the bus to a plane. I'm glad I'm flying to Dubai and I probably won't get a bus.
Famous last words.
Then I check the departure board and it says gate shown at 11:40 a.m. It's 11:38. So I say to my wife, let's go get some overpriced Pret and head to the gate. We might have to get a train to the sea gates. Then I check the LHR departures on the internet. And what do I see? A10. My first reaction was, you have got to be kidding. And then I laughed and thought, well, at least I understand his struggles when Dan talks about it. Long story short, about gate A10, that will forever be a memory.
Oh my God. I'm with you. It's a thing, because only after I started roasting Dan about it, now even I get A10. And I never used to get A10. Yeah. And I was only... I've had A10 even to the point that originally it was like A2 and then it switched back to please wait. And I was like, oh, maybe, you know, delay. And then it was like A10. I was like, you've got to be kidding. What is happening? Dude, does that mean I need to stop roasting Dan about it? But yeah, it's a thing. It's an on-air podcast thing. It happens to the listeners. It's one of those kind of like side effects. You know, when you have an advert in the US and then they say side effects may include blah, 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 blah. So this is like on air with Dan and Alex. Side effects may include a healthy dose of gate A10 terminal 5.
Exactly.
Dan, I want to hear. Let's have you take it away with everything we need to know in what's happening with miles and points. We've had loads of people send in their questions to you, and I think you've chosen the ones that are going to be most beneficial for the wider masses. Not too specific, but specific enough that we're able to
to gain some knowledge on how to, what to do with our miles and points.
Oh my God, don't overhype this too much, but there's going to be some good advice, I'm sure. Welcome to Dan's solo point session. Alex doesn't really know what I'm talking about here. I know he wishes he would learn what I'm talking about. So when he listens back to this, he's going to learn a lot. But no shade to Alex. He's great at redeeming certain points, but we both decided this is just the place for Dan. So here we go, guys. I'm going to answer your points related questions that have sort of been building up. So we want to get through these, and I'm going to start by finding a question here. Okay, this is not necessarily directly points related, but it's related to airline award programs. So Mr. Fung, I don't have his first name, but he asks, best program in each alliance for lifetime status. That is a good one, because lifetime status is something, I don't know, I feel like it's spoken about a lot in the points community, but basically what it is if you fly, let's say 8, 10, 15 years or a certain distance, and you manage to maintain a status through those years or just manage to reach a certain distance, you'll get silver, gold, platinum, whatever it might be, status for the rest of your life with that airline, which can be incredibly valuable, but the threshold is very high to get there. So for example, I think what comes to mind first is in SkyTeam, we have Air France KLM. Flying Blue has a very generous lifetime status program. Basically, you need to be a platinum member for 10 years. And being platinum requires to renew platinum is quite easy compared to earning it the first time. It requires 300 XPs per year, as they call it. Now, anyone who doesn't know what an XP is going to be like, WTF. An XP is sort of like a credit from a flight. So some domestic flights in business class will earn 6 XPs for one flight. A long-haul flight in business could earn 24 or 30 or 36 XPs, depending on the length. So it doesn't matter how much you paid, but also this is specifically for paid tickets. With most airlines, this does not work with award tickets. So let's say, an average 10-hour flight is going to be 30 XPs with Flying Blue. You need 300 to earn platinum. That means that you're taking 10-hour business class flights a year for 10 years to maintain that status in order to get platinum status for life. The benefits of platinum are amazing. So it's not like you're necessarily sacrificing, or it might be a worthwhile investment, let's say. So I think they have the best in SkyTeam. In Oneworld, I would say definitely my favorite frequent flyer program in general and for lifetime status is the BA Executive Club. If you earn 35,000 tier points, so it's similar to XPs in the sense that you earn a set number of tier points per flight, a long-haul business class flight is usually 140 tier points. So the good thing about BA Executive Club is that you can earn the highest status, which would be lifetime gold, in just a few years if you're flying a ton. Basically, you have to earn 35,000 tier points over the course of your life, and then you get Oneworld Emerald status or BA Gold, which, you need 1,500 to earn gold in a year. So if you fly 1,500 a year, it's going to take you much longer to earn lifetime status than it would with Air France KLM. But there's a set number without a time requirement. So I would say 35,000 is quite good. So in Star Alliance, I would say United now is the best. Theirs is purely distance-based. So unlike European airlines, for example, you just need to fly a certain number of miles and you get lifetime status. This is the same as with Delta and American. So for gold status with United, which is the same as Star Alliance gold, that's the best status in Star Alliance. So that's what you want to have. You need to fly 1,000,000 miles, but that's only on United. And I know what Alex is saying. He's, getting goosebumps and saying, I don't think I would fly United for 1,000,000 miles if someone paid me. I have to say, I sort of agree. So this is not the most appealing lifetime status to go for, but I still think it's the most achievable in Star Alliance at the moment. What other questions do we have? Let's see here. HCA Bot 15. I don't think this is a bot, but because they have a profile picture and they follow me. But anyway, how often do you have to cancel or move tentative trips because of no good award tickets? Well, obviously, okay, if you don't know how award tickets work, every seat on every flight usually is not available as an award ticket, at least as a cheap one. Some airlines make all seats available, but it could cost hundreds of thousands of points, making it a very bad deal. So the question here is, if I'm planning a trip, I can't find award space, what do I do? Well, this, to be very honest, this has never happened to me. I always either, luckily I'm flexible, so I can go a bit earlier or a bit later or take a detour. But even if I wait to the last minute, I've never had to not take a trip because I couldn't find award space. Because there are almost, I would say 99% of the time, there has always been award space. If there hasn't, it's been because I had to fly at a very specific time on a very specific day. And then you just have to suck it up and pay cash. Then I might do economy or premium economy if you don't have much choice. But yeah, I'm really a person who wants to get the best deal possible. So I will wait until the last minute if that's what it takes to get a good points ticket. Tom asks about the best way to get Avios specifically for Qatar Airways. Avios is the currency used by Qatar Airways, by British Airways, by Iberia, by Finnair. It's an awesome cross-airline currency that stretches even between their separate frequent flyer programs, which is very unique. So these points can be used to redeem on a bunch of different airlines, and as Tom is saying here, specifically for Qatar Airways as well. So how do you earn them? What's the best way? Well, quick plug here for my course Points Master, where I help hundreds of people learn how to master the art of buying and redeeming points. So you can go from 0 points with any airline and zero experience and be booking your first business class flight within a few hours. I'm going to put a link to the course in the show notes below this so you can check it out if you want to. But it's truly a way you can change your life and change the comfort of how you or your loved ones travel. And I know a lot of people joining Points Master are looking to fly Qatar Airways specifically. So I help with this in a very detailed way. Also, if you're starting with 0 points, it can be a bit tricky because you can't just buy points outright with any of the Avios programs if you don't have at least 1 point in your account. If you do have points and you have any way of earning them, whether you go through a shopping portal and book a hotel, or you take a flight, or you can transfer from a credit card in many countries, the very cheapest way to get them is to use British Airways Boost feature. And I talk about this, I go through how to do it in Points Master. Basically, the points you've earned in the past 30 days can be boosted 3x. So if you get 20,000 points by flying or whatever it may be, you can boost that and end up with 80,000 points in total. So you're buying 60,000 points and you'll be buying those for just $12 per thousand, which is an incredible rate. So if you look at what a Qatar Airways flight costs from Europe to Doha, it's 43,000 points for most of the year. So 43 times 12, it's around $600 or so. You add some taxes. So we're talking in general, by using this technique, you're paying between $600 and $700 each way from Doha to Europe. You add 2,000 points to add a connection in the Middle East. And this is in business class, by the way. In Middle East, you add a connection in first class. And that is how I would do it. Phoebe says, big fan. Hi, Phoebe. How do you protect your credit score with all the credit card applications? So this is more US specific, but in any country where you're applying for credit cards, it will take a ding on your credit score. So what I do is I try to space out my applications. I won't apply for cards, every month. I try to be strategic. So I have two player mode with Oscar. So I will apply for a card for him 1 month. Then the next I'll do one for me. Then the next I'll do one for him. There's some banks, like for example, if you have an existing relationship with a bank, like this is the case with American Express in the US, they won't pull your credit score to check an approval for a new card. So I'll try to consider that as well. So I might do 1 month, let's say a Capital One card or a Chase card for me. The next month, I'll do one of those for Oscar, refer him, of course. Then the next month, let's be realistic. I'm opening a card like every 2 to 3 months. So 2 months later, I might do an American Express card, a business card. So it doesn't show up in my one out of five for Chase in the US. I know this is getting very complicated. And then I'll do one of those for Oscar. And then I'll wait another few months and do another bank. So I space it out. I try to make sure I'll get a guaranteed approval as well by doing research. So Googling how to, you know, have the best odds of getting approved for X card. And again, this should work in most countries. Many countries also have credit card forums on Reddit, for example. So if you're unsure and you want to get into using credit card points, just Google in your home language, wherever you are, credit cards, the country you live in, Reddit, and you might find a forum where you can read guidance, ask questions, and those types of things.
Well, that was super informative. Thank you so much. And I think with that, we'll wrap up on today's episode. Guys, thank you for joining us as always, and we look forward to having you again with us, same time, same place, this time next week.
Can't
see you later.
Wait, we'll see you then on air. Bye-bye.
It's a great time to save big on everything for your next project at Menards. Get free estimates fast on new energy-efficient windows from Jeld-Wen. Choose from vinyl or wood windows and customize the perfect size and unique features for your home. Save big on all Jeld-Wen windows today. View our entire selection of Jeld-Wen windows on Menards.com. Plus, the weekly flyer for other great deals happening now. Save big.